listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm John Rubino, filling in for Jay Taylor, who is off visiting a gold mine. I'm here with Chris Martinson, founder of peakprosperity.com, through which he helps people prepare not just their finances, but their entire lives for what he and I both see as a very challenging decade ahead. Hi, Chris.
Hey, John. So good to be with you here.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
You know, Michael Oliver was just on before you, and we talked about the stock market's recent craziness. So let me start you off with the same question I asked Michael. Mm-hmm. What the heck just happened? And what does it mean?
Yeah. Well, my analysis comes down to, I wrote a piece on it and put it out this morning, which is that this was a breakdown in volatility trading. So everybody's familiar, if you've been following the markets at all, with this idea that there are a lot of very crowded trades out there. And one of them is everybody was short volatility, meaning they were positioned big time for the markets not to be volatile. And of course, when markets looked like they were going to become volatile, this became a self-fulfilling feedback loop. And what happened was volatility spiked, and then that drags all the computers off, and they have to go do what they do, because when volatility spikes, stocks get sold. There was no pin out there that said, you know, bad earnings report or, you know, super surprise inflation reading, none of that. It was just all of a sudden volatility spiked. And because everything is connected to everything these days, that's the craziness we saw.
And does that have longer term implications? You know, was this a 1 week thing, or have we entered a bear market that's going to be like 2008, 2009, which so many people on the, you know, the contrarian side of the spectrum have been waiting for?
Well, I think the second part of the story is, can they, quotes around the word they, can they contain this? We all are familiar with the idea that we have very interventionist central banks now. Japan was in big time, of course, buying more ETFs for the Bank of Japan. And so we watched the rescue efforts come along. The question, the key question that we all have to watch very carefully here is, can they actually get the cash markets to come back in a meaningful way or not? And if they can't, this is, I think, John, the most dangerous thing that could happen is the loss of perception that the central bankers can contain these Franken markets that they've created. And so we saw the first hints yesterday that said, nope, guess what? From time to time, markets are still bigger than central banks. That's what we saw Friday. That's what we saw Monday. Today, we're seeing a rescue effort. I can't wait to see how it turns out. If they don't contain this, I think it could be a really dangerous, unpleasant reversion to the mean, which is a fancy way of saying a 50% haircut.
Yeah, because if you just look at historical valuations on the major equity markets now, they need to fall by half just to get back to normal levels of valuation. And yeah. frequently you see things, you know, they go a lot further than just mean reversion and then come back. So, you know, the 60% or 70% from these levels doesn't seem outrageous.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, of course, they, again, with the quotes around it, are not really interested in seeing that happen for a whole variety of reasons, not the least of which is, you know, what did we see the last time that we had too much credit and we had a lot of malinvestment, which we called the subprime housing crisis, but this time we might use words like student debt or subprime auto or, you know, lending a lot of money to Kazakhstan. Whatever the story is, this time there's been the same amount of malinvestment. It's spread all over the place. And what they fear is that if these contagious events begin to really catch on and they go down, you get that deflationary bust that ruins institutions. It takes out sovereign nations potentially. It certainly nibbles at all the edges of all the weaker companies that are out there. But I mean, let's recount two places central banks might be desperately afraid here. One, if you're the European Central Bank and you are the proud owner of or creator of a junk debt universe in Europe that's trading with a 2% handle, that's something to fear, because the losses that are potentially going to arise there are just magnificent. Or two, you might be the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and you're afraid of the fact that because you've created these Franken markets, I was shocked when I saw this statistic, you're probably familiar with it, that the typical pension fund is now 60-40 stocks to bonds, not bonds to stocks. They've completely inverted that. So if you are responsible for trillions of dollars in pension assets, those are now entirely exposed to stocks. Let me just put this on the table. A 50% or more overshoot situation, the price of stocks going down, will absolutely destroy $1 or more trillion of pensions at this point, irrecoverably.
So we would see Chicago go bankrupt in that kind of a scenario, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're insolvent, you know, already, because the fund, the assets and the liabilities are in a mismatch. Bankruptcy is the legal term for when you have to go to court to figure out what to do about that. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think it was just yesterday in Rhode Island, a bunch of state workers, municipal workers whose pensions were being attacked by the state went to court, made all the way to the state Supreme Court. And their argument was, the workers' argument was, hey, these are contracts, they need to be enforced like contracts. And the Supreme Court, surprise, surprise, sided with the government of Rhode Island and said, nah, the state can do whatever it wants. And they just unilaterally invalidated those contracts. So, yes, rules get changed. But when the states face bankruptcy like that, I think what happens is it's just the pensioners who end up getting a one-way haircut with not a lot of recourse.
Yeah. So a lot of people who think they exist at a certain level of wealth because they have a nice, for instance, public sector pension, will find out that they're not nearly as well off as they thought they were. And that's got to have a huge psychological impact on the country when it happens.
Exactly. And I'm glad you're talking about the psychology of this, because, you know, again, if the markets lose the perception that the central banks have this all under control, we get that mean reverting event. Or once the country loses the perception that their pensions and other savings are sacrosanct or in some way going to be meaningful, it's the perception's everything in a game like this. Because, of course, we have a Ponzi-like fiat money system where the money itself is corrupt at its core and allows all sorts of crazy things to happen like this. So I think it's just a feature of our money system that you have periods of time where you delude yourself by printing a lot of money and pretending it's real wealth and prosperity, and then reality comes along and you're like, whoops, that was a dumb idea, and wash, rinse, repeat, right? We've been down this cycle so many times. The only surprising feature of it is that people still fall for it, and we have to learn the lessons all over again.
Okay. Now, one of the really interesting aspects of the work that you do is that you go beyond finance. You know, you explain how to invest for crazy times, but you also talk about the other things people should be doing with their lives in order to, you know, survive and thrive when things get as crazy as they probably will. So could we talk about a few things in that category? In other words, what are the two or three things you would recommend that I and the other listeners out there should start doing with their lives in order to be ready for what's coming?
Yeah, I'd love to. Because, you know, I do talk about markets and finance a lot because everybody cares about it. And I think that's where we'll get some early signals. But I'm not in this to help, you know, get people just financially secure. That's part of it. But really, you know, what's the purpose of life? We're here to have happy, fulfilled, meaningful, purposeful lives. And a lot of us are, a lot of people, including myself as of a few years ago, are exposed to this idea that if I lose my job, I'm really ruined, or if my financial situation really goes away, I'm ruined. All sorts of things could come and disrupt our lives. And when I look at the world around us, I see a lot of chance for those disruptions. So Adam Taggart and myself, we've been at this for 10 years, and we asked ourselves some questions, which were, what are some things we could do that would be really additive to our lives today, but also would make us more prepared, more resilient for whatever future arrives? And we've come up with a list of those. Financial capital, hey, build it up. It's fantastic. You know, make sure it's safe. You know, be smart. Understand the big picture, where we're going. But none are so poor as those who only have money. So what else can we do with our lives to add that richness? There are seven other forms of capital that we like to talk about, that's written up in the book Prosper. We spend weekend seminars digging deeper. And some examples are social capital, right? So if you have a rich social network, not just how many people you know, but how well you know them and how much you can trust the people in your network, this is shown to be a great additive to your current life as well as in the future. We know from watching what's happening in Venezuela now, or what just happened in Zimbabwe, or what happens when countries get into financial crises, that who you know and how well you know them are real determinants of whether you're simply surviving or you're thriving in those environments. So social capital, lots of ways to get out there and build it. And, you know, it involves, in many cases, being bold, dropping your masks, bringing out your vulnerable self and really connecting with people. We talk about lots of ways to do that. And another example would be living capital, which includes the health and state of your own body, as well as the ecology around you, whether you have the opportunity to put in a garden or, you know, plant different plantings that can really help bring more food to the local birds, bees, and everything else. This living capital is really important. Adam and I are both in much better shape than we were 10 years ago, and that adds so much to our daily lives today. And in future scenarios, being healthy is, of course, going to be very important. So those are just, you know, three of the eight forms of capital. I don't know if you want me to step through all of them, but we find that if people become resilient in each one of these eight forms, even just a little bit, they do so much better than if they just build one of them up.
Fascinating. Chris, give us a couple more if you've got them at your fingertips.
Well, sure. I mean, everybody's familiar with, you know, often when people hear about possible disruptions in the future, you know, whether they live on the Juan de Fuca plate fault line out there in the Northwest, or, you know, hurricanes just come through, or they're worried a financial crisis is going to come, they usually go right to material preparations, right? So you see a lot of prepper websites carry a lot of that, which is fine. I'm a big believer in being prepared. So material capital, though, could be having a deep pantry. It could be, in my case, I put on solar hot water and solar photovoltaics on my house because I believe in hot water and electricity big time. But these are ways that I can put my money, my financial capital, slide it out of that bucket and slide it into making my house more well insulated so I use less energy going forward, and making energy investments that have a positive return that's better than anything Wall Street can promise me. And I'm using that word carefully. You have a promised return from some of these investments. And so material capital is really great to build up. But again, prepping is about so much more than just having a deep pantry and maybe some food in the basement. Another one that's exceedingly important, perhaps the most important one, is emotional capital. And this sort of touches in maybe on spiritual as well. And this is, listen, let's say you're fantastically wealthy in all other seven forms of capital, but in emotional capital, you're kind of thin. Crisis comes along and you just crumble. You can't manage. You can't deal with the whole thing. You might as well not have any of the other forms of capital, which is why I'm saying this one's really important. And so here it's a little bit less prescriptive because each person's different, but to really be able to build up your emotional resilience so that you can separate reacting from responding, so that when the times really become turbulent, if or when that happens, you have a clear head. You have a plan, you can stick to it, you know what you're going to do, you've already thought through or experienced some of the harder edges of the decisions that are going to have to be made. Because let's be clear, when or if we do have that 50% reversion, you and I and everybody listening, we're going to know people, maybe it's us, who have lost their jobs, who have come into hard times, and it's going to be up to us, people who have been emotionally prepared, ready for this, we saw it coming. We know how we're going to help people and where our limits are and what we can do. And so you really want to build up that emotional resilience before a crisis starts. And guess what? If you start doing that, your relationships will begin to change and shift. And this emotional capital is something that adds a lot of richness to your lives and to your ability to connect deeply. And so this is just something that, again, whether or not, however the future turns out, nobody can predict that. But I can guarantee you that if you are building up these forms of capital I've talked about, you will be happier, healthier, richer, and more engaged and present with life today. So for Adam and I, this is kind of a win-win. We don't see, you know, you know, we don't live in fear, John, that someday we're going to wake up and somebody's going to knock on our door and say, you bastards, you know, 8 years ago, you told me to get in shape and have better relationships and be careful with my money. And I regret all of that. we just don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, excellent. Now, you mentioned energy briefly a few minutes ago, and energy actually plays a big part in your macro worldview too. Could you expand a little bit on the whole exponential growth, limits to growth kinds of thesis that you espouse?
Well, sure. I mean, your listeners should know that my background, I'm a scientist by training, and so I love data. But I was a biological scientist, so I understand really very professionally as well as possibly intuitively at this point that energy is everything. Organisms either have access to energy or they don't. If there's a lot of rabbits around, next year you're going to have a lot of foxes, right? So watching that happen, once you understand the role that fossil fuels have played in bringing us all the abundance we live with today, and by the way, we live in one of the most abundant eras ever for humans, but we're also eating those fossil fuels. 10 calories of every, in every calorie you eat, there's 10 calories of fossil fuels embedded in there. So, hey, maybe we should go study this stuff called fossil fuels, which is coal, natural gas, but mostly oil is the big one. And there, as soon as you dig into this story of oil, you discover that, yes, we're finding more, but it's deeper, it's harder to get to, it involves fracking, 10,000-foot wells that deplete in 3 years, that we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel, and most people don't know this. So once you study that, you know the importance of energy to our entire system of money, to our entire way we organize ourselves economically, to our hopes, our dreams, to the fact that we eat as well as we do. All of these things depend on energy, and when you get in there, like I do, and really dig around, you say, oh my gosh, in our lifetimes, this entire story changes. And some people interpret that as, oh, you're just saying it's going to be a disaster. Hey, we're humans, we're clever, we'll figure stuff out, but the reorganization is going to be dramatic. Some crisis in that, some opportunity in that. Crisis is for anybody expecting, requiring, needing the future to be just like today, but just larger, that ain't going to happen. Sooner or later, we have to figure out how to reshape that. So, you know, losers in that story are going to be exurbs that are 90 miles away from where the jobs are, the really distant strip malls at the edges of things. The future that I see coming is we're going to have to be a lot more careful with our energy use. We're going to have to reshape where we live, eat, work, play. There's opportunity in that, of course. But it's not just a simple continuation of here to there. Things change enormously. And once you understand where China is on this macro stage, they are already the world's largest importer of oil. That's set to double their number of imports in the next 12 years. We don't know where all that oil is going to come from. China's already on it. They're reshaping Middle East politics. They're magic checkbooking their way through every oil deposit you can find. And the United States is still pretending as if, we don't have to, nothing here to think about. So really big changes coming for people who can see that. I think there's extraordinary investment opportunities as well as losses in some of these cases.
Okay. Chris, we've got exactly 1 minute left. Could you talk a little bit about what the energy thesis means for agriculture?
Yeah, so agriculture is heavily dependent on fossil fuel inputs. All the nitrogen comes from natural gas through the Haber-Bosch process, the plowing, that. So, and moving water is really energy expensive. It's heavy. It doesn't like to move. So through all of this, we find that energy and food prices are intimately linked. As oil prices go up in the next 3 to 5 years, food prices are going to go up because that's how that works. So I'm looking for commodities, in particular grains, to be really at the bottom of their investment cycle. They're going to all be going up in price as we go forward. And there will be lots of skirmishes, might be the right word, but those could be market skirmishes for grains as we go forward. Really tight situation as we look forward 10, 20 years for food coming in.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, Chris. Great talking to you, and talk to you soon, hopefully.
All right. Thank you, John.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this segment, but please don't go away because right after the break, you'll hear a pre-recorded interview that Jay Taylor did with Jean Martineau, the CEO of Dynacore Gold Mines, one of Jay's favorite junior miners.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdes Reward Project. In addition, Novo has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Bonterra Resources, a Canadian exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. In 2017, Bonterra raised $40 million and attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kinross, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based VanEck Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource model in 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000-plus meters of drilling where the dimensions of the Gladiator gold deposit has been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under BONXF.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.